Okay, how about we start? Our speaker today is Richard Woodard from the University of Florida. Questions and answers on perturbative ground gravity. Richard?
Okay, thank you, Jorge, and thank you for the invitation to address this body. I'd like to begin, so let's go to slide number 2, the one that's entitled 7 Questions. I'd like to begin by posing and then spending the rest of the seminar discussing 7 questions that interested me way back when I started the field, working on the field 30 years ago. The first question is, why is quantum general relativity so bad in view of the fact that we all know that classical general relativity is so good that we can't even find any disagreement with it? Second question is, why must we quantize gravity at all in view of the fact that the classical theory is so great? Third is, you all know that quantum gravity has problems with divergences. Why do quantum field theories have divergences? Why are those of quantum gravity so much worse than that of other theories? How bad is the problem? What are the main approaches to it? And what would we do with the theory of quantum general relativity if we had one? Now go to the third slide, the one that's labeled Sketch of General Relativity. I often give talks that are very similar to this to audiences of non-specialists. I know that you all know general relativity probably much better than I do, but about half the slides of this talk are for the non-specialist kind of talk. So let me begin by a sketch of general relativity. When you define any theory, you should always give the dynamical variable, explain how it is that that affects the rest of physics, and then how it is that physics affects it. So for general relativity, the dynamical variable is the metric, a 4x4 function of space and time. It affects the other fields of physics by changing the way it is that that their derivatives are affected through minimal coupling. The other fields affect general relativity through the Einstein equation, which takes the form of a function of second derivatives of the metric is equal to 8 pi g Newton's constant times the stress energy tensor, where that's the good old stress energy tensor from classical physics. And a key principle, and actually only one of two that I really need about general relativity for this talk, is that the source of energy is the source of gravity is energy. Of course, you all know that this equation also predicts the existence of gravitational radiation, that is, purely gravitational degrees of freedom that aren't fixed by the stress-energy tensor, by the matter-stress-energy tensor. And that's true, but that turns out to play a very, very small role in the problems of perturbative quantum gravity, and that's one of my main messages of this talk, is that gravitons are not the problem of quantum general relativity. So now let's go to the fourth slide, the one that's dealing with the difference between a solution versus the general solution. So this deals with the first question, which is, why is quantum general relativity such a problematic theory in view of the fact that classical general relativity is so great? And the first point that I want to make is that if you just look at a equation, at a Heisenberg field equation, you can't tell the difference between it or even the solution between classical physics and quantum physics. The field equations and their solutions are exactly the same in quantum mechanics as they are in classical mechanics. So, for example, take the harmonic oscillator equation for a one-dimensional point particle x of t. The solution I've given is x0 cosine omega t plus dot, 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 dot. And that's exactly the same solution as it would be in classical physics. The only difference is that in classical physics, x0 and x0 dot are just numbers that you could set to any value you wanted to, whereas in quantum physics, they're operators, and they have to obey the uncertainty principle. You could still think about them classically, but it's no longer possible to set them both to definite values. You have to allow a certain amount of jitter. And it turns out that that actually is the key distinction between classical general relativity, which works so great, and quantum general relativity, which screws up so badly. Because all the classical tests of general relativity, when you think about it, or at least the principal ones, are based on the solar system, based on the Schwarzschild solution, in fact. And when we do that, we're setting almost all the degrees of freedom equal to zero. So the full degrees of freedom actually would be very complicated to specify, but they're essentially some components of the metric at t equals zero and some of their time derivatives at t equals zero. They could, and that's an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Whereas if you look at the Schwarzschild solution, it's actually just got basically one degree of freedom in it. And that's the thing which works so well. Well, we can do that in classical physics, no problem at all, because in classical physics, those pieces of initial value data are just numbers, and we can set them to anything we want. But in quantum physics, you can't do that. You have to allow each of them to be a little bit excited. And that's actually the thing that causes the problem of quantum gravity, is that there's so many degrees of freedom, each with a little bit of excitation, which, as you know, is called zero-point motion. So now let's go to the fifth slide, which deals with the second question, and that is, why do we have to quantize gravity at all? So back when I started, it was completely respectable to ask that question and to try and come up with ways of keeping gravity completely classical. One of the really interesting things is that we know that you can't do that right now, at least under the simplest interpretation of the data coming in from cosmology about the origin of primordial perturbations in the universe. And that's one of my other main messages, is that some quantization is unavoidable. The reason why that's true is that gravity, as for all other force fields, has a dual role. So it does the thing that the people who devised it intended in the first place, that is, it mediates the long-range interactions that we observed, but it also does something that they didn't intend when they created it, and that is that it harbors new quanta. Those for gravity are the gravitational radiation. So if I want to keep this simple, let's look at the case of electrodynamics, for which the Maxwell equations in MKS units are given on the slide. And if I treat the sources, rho and j, as fixed, then I can write down the general solution for this thing. And the general solution is that expression for the magnetic field. You can also write down a general solution for the electric field. But for my purposes, let's just look at the general solution of the magnetic field. So it's actually just consisting of two lines. The first line is the part that's mediating long-range interactions. So it's the part that's completely controlled by what the current density is. And the second part is the purely electrodynamic part that has nothing to do with the current and would be there even if you didn't have any current at all. That's the photon part. And gravity has the same kind of situation in it, and let's notice that the first term, so suppose we were having the same kind of debate about whether or not to quantize electrodynamics, you could notice that the first part, the part that that involves just the currents, has to be quantized because that's based on stuff like the electron field and proton fields and everything that we have enormously powerful evidence is quantized. Whether or not there even are electrodynamic degrees of freedom or whether or not they're quantized. And it turns out that that same thing is true of gravity as well, and it's that part which is causing the lowest order problems. So now let's go to the sixth slide, the thing that's entitled matter is quantized. So matter is quantized whether or not photons and gravitons are. So, for example, to take another electrodynamic example, consider the hydrogen atom, for which the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m minus e phi of q, where phi of q is the usual result. And that, if we were doing non-relativistic hydrogen, would be an operator. But it would only be an operator in the sense that it depends upon the quantum operator Q. It wouldn't be an operator in the sense that we've quantized photons, so it doesn't have any quantum degrees of freedom for the photon, but it's still a quantum operator just because of its dependence upon the matter field which causes it, in this case the nucleus of the atom. And the same thing is true for general relativity. That is, we can't be as explicit for general relativity, and that's a big headache, but if you sort of think qualitatively, we can write the metric as some part of it, which is just a functional of the stress tensor, and then another part of it, which is the gravitational degrees of freedom. And the fields, whether or not there even are gravitons and whether or not they're quantized, the matter fields in Team Innu are certainly quantized. There's enormously powerful evidence about that, and you can't ignore that. And that part alone is responsible for the lowest order problems in quantum gravity, whether or not you have gravitons. Gravitons also cause problems at higher orders in the loop expansion, but it's that part, the part that depends just on the matter sources, which causes the lowest order problems in quantum gravity. And I need to say one other thing, and that is that we've actually seen the quantum nature of that part. If you take the simplest nature, take the simplest explanation of the source of primordial perturbations in the universe. So it's no longer possible, if, again, you make the simplest interpretation of what WMAP and the structure surveys are telling us, it's no longer possible to adopt the point of view that we want to take gravity is being sourced by the expectation value of the stress tensor in the presence of some state. So now I'd like to go to the seventh slide, the one that deals with asymptotic series. Well, I told you that the quantum equations are the same as the classical equations, so naively speaking, what would we do? Well, we just solve them exactly, right? Of course, that's impossible to get the exact solution, the general initial value solution, and that means that you're going to have to use some kind of approximation technique. The approximation technique in quantum field theory generally is known as perturbation theory, and that's what I'm going to talk about in this talk. That kind of grosses out people who are mathematically minded, and I want to deal with that that feeling of distaste and disgust about using perturbation theory. The thing that bothers people about that is that it generates only an asymptotic series expansion of the thing, and the asymptotic series cannot by itself define the theory. There certainly are non-perturbative phenomena. There certainly are things that are not recovered in the asymptotic series, and it doesn't converge, actually. You can prove that it would diverge. Nonetheless, I want to convince you that it should be a pretty good way of understanding quantum gravity. The right asymptotic series should be a pretty good way of understanding quantum gravity for all purposes that we're going to, that we're likely to encounter in any sort of way that we can check quantum gravity. And let me take as my example the asymptotic series for the exponential integral function, which is the integral from x to infinity of dt over t times e to the minus t. The asymptotic series of that would just be e to the minus x over x times a series in powers of 1 over x, okay, times an n factorial. And this is a great series expansion, as you can see, when x is large or when 1 over x is the small parameter, provided you don't sum all the way up to n equals infinity. Because if you do sum up to n equals infinity, you can see that because of that awful n factorial in there, it's going to diverge. So what do you do with this thing? Well, you ask the question, okay, suppose I'm at 10th order and I want to go to 11th order. Does the result, does the extra term that I add from that series make it smaller or bigger? Well, as long as n is less than about x, then it will actually be smaller. And you can show, because we have the full integral of this thing, and you can actually check it explicitly, and we have an analytic form for the remainder function, you can show that that actually increases accuracy until you get out to about n is of order x. And at that point, adding extra terms actually makes the accuracy worse. And that's actually the thing which grosses people out about series which are only asymptotic and not convergent. Is that fact that you cannot get more and more accurate. There's a limit to how accurate you can get. And they're absolutely right. That could never serve as the fundamental definition of quantum gravity. Nonetheless, for all practical purposes, it's sometimes plenty good enough. And let's quantify that, because we live in a real world where if the theory is going to be checked, people will have to do experiments, and the measurements can't be infinitely accurate, and let's see how good that is. So I want to go now to the eighth slide, which is labeled that it should be great for quantum general relativity, and let's first consider the situation in quantum electrodynamics for which the loop counting parameter, the thing that you're actually doing an asymptotic series expansion in, is called alpha. And as you all know, its numerical value at low energies is about 1 over 137. A typical result for any prediction of quantum electrodynamics would be the zeroth order term, and then times a series, which goes like 1 plus a pure number times alpha plus another pure number times alpha squared, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those pure numbers, alpha 1 and alpha 2, could be functions of the momenta, but they're dimensionless functions of whatever are the parameters which characterize the thing you're looking at. And if you take careful or pay careful attention to how it is that the combinatorics go, you can show that just like the series expansion for the exponential integral, this thing also accumulates factors of not only alpha, but also 2L minus 1 double factorial. And that means that it's going to begin diverging at about L equals 430. Well, is that a problem or not? Well, no, it isn't, because the best experiment that has ever been done in quantum electrodynamics is only sensitive to a little bit more than the for loop term. And getting the for loop term, by the way, took the efforts of every single person who works in this field working for years. It is extremely doubtful whether we'll even be able to measure the five-loop term, and getting out to something like 430 order is just ridiculous moonshine. So the fact that the series is only asymptotic and that that it can't serve to define the theory and that you can't make the answer infinitely accurate by adding more and more and more terms is a mathematical problem, and it is something that does need to be addressed, but in terms of practically doing the hard work of physics, of taking a theory, making predictions, comparing with the experiments, getting quantitative agreement between the two, and being pretty sure you're understanding how the dynamics works, it is no problem at all. Okay, so that's how it works in quantum electrodynamics. How would it work in quantum gravity? Well, the coupling constant of quantum gravity is Newton's constant. That's dimensionful, unlike alpha, so it has to go together with some parameters of whatever problem you're understanding. It's usual to characterize that in terms of an energy, a characteristic energy or mass of whatever calculation you're doing. There are some H-bars and Cs that go together in it. And when you plug in all the numbers, that turns out to be an expansion in this characteristic energy over a huge energy, 10 to the 19th GeV, the whole thing squared. And the results of quantum gravity are typically zeroth order plus times a series that goes like 1 plus B kappa plus B2 kappa squared plus dot, 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 dot. If only, those numbers B1 and B2 were just pure numbers, finite pure numbers after you renormalize the theory, then this series ought to be fantastically better even than the series for quantum electrodynamics. Why? Well, first off, the factorials are not any worse than they are for quantum electrodynamics. Secondly, the parameter is enormously smaller at any energy you're going to reach in the laboratory. We've spent, over a decade building the LHC, and the biggest energy we're going to reach there is, I think, 9 TeV. So I put in 1 TeV, and that would give kappa about 10 to the minus 32. Well, we can't possibly hope to measure that accuracy. So if those numbers B1 and B2 were just pure numbers of order 1, then the series that you would get would be fantastically accurate and totally good enough for any sort of quantitative comparison with experiment. Unfortunately, those numbers, B1 and B2, wind up diverging. And that ultimately, well, that's one of the problems with quantum gravity. The other problem is, suppose you got a theory for which B1 and B2 were finite. Since those numbers are so small, then, how would you wind up comparing it quantitatively with experiments and seeing that you had the right theory of quantum gravity? So I'd like to move now to slide number 9, which deals with the physics behind the infinities. And for that, I'd like to first recall the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator, for which the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m plus 1 half m omega squared q squared, where q is the position of a point particle in one dimension. And you all know that the general solution can be written like that. It's usual in textbooks to do a really complicated song and dance to try and get the raising and lowering operators, but it turns out that in the Heisenberg picture, it's very, very trivial to do this. The way that you do it is to just take the sine omega t and the cosine omega t apart using the Euler relation, and then isolate the term which goes like e to the minus I omega t and the term which goes like e to the plus I omega t. Those are eigenoperators of the Hamiltonian, so it must be that the e to the minus I omega t term lowers the energy by h bar omega, and the term proportional to e to the plus I omega t raises the energy by h bar omega. And then after you normalize the commutators to get the commutator of A and A dagger to be 1, you actually reach the usual canonical free field expansion of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, so that same pattern is repeated for all quantum field theories in flat space background with zero background and at the free level, and it has two features that are important for us. First, the mode coordinates in the harmonic oscillator, those are the raising and lowering operators, A and A dagger, and those are just linear combinations of the initial value data, the P's and Q's, which remember in quantum mechanics can't all be equal to zero. And then the C number function of time, and in a field theory also space, which multiplies them. That's the mode function for which in the harmonic oscillator it's e to the minus I omega t over square root of 2 omega. And let's move on now to see how that looks in a field theory. So I want to move to slide number 10. Field theories have an infinite number of modes. So, for example, let's consider electrodynamics in a conducting cube of side length L. So the expansion for the X component of the electric field takes the form of a sum over the allowed Fourier momenta, K, where K is pi over L times a three-tuplet of integers, of A sub K and A sub K dagger times mode functions. So it's exactly that same pattern as we saw in the harmonic oscillator, just repeated for each of the hello?
Pardon?
Okay, so for each of the mode, for each of the wave numbers, K, and I've given explicitly what the mode functions are, but the important thing is that there's two modes for every N1, N2, and N3 in this system, and there's a lot of N1, N2s, and N3s. Okay, well, now we can see sort of in gross, at a gross level, why it is that this problem is happening. It's due to a conspiracy of four principles. The first one is the one that I just mentioned on the last transparency, so we're up to slide number 11 right now, the conspiracy of four principles. And the first one is, like I said, the one that I just discussed, that continuum field theories have an infinite number of modes, okay? The second one is quantum mechanics, which tells you that those mode coordinates, which are linear combinations of the initial values of the fields and their first time derivatives, cannot both be set equal to zero. Remember, general relativity works so great when we set both of them equal to zero for almost every degree of freedom. You cannot do that. Each mode must, you can still think of them sort of quasi-classically, but each mode has to have a little bit of energy called zero-point motion. And that zero-point motion is actually observed and observable and has real effects. The third principle is general relativity, and for that I just need the fact that this zero-point motion gravitates, so it has a gravitational effect. And the fourth principle is perturbation theory. So it would be great if we could do this calculation exactly. Unfortunately, we don't have analytic power for it, or at least I don't have the analytic power to do that. So we use this grungy technique of perturbation theory, and in perturbation theory, at lowest order, these shifts in the energy density that you get from putting a source present just add up, okay? And you've got a contribution coming from something which is affecting the zero-point energy, which is gravitating. And to get the gravitational effect of that, you just add up the effect from all the modes. And so the ultimate problem comes from the fact that you've got too many modes interacting too strongly. So that's the basic reason why we're having divergences and why it is that that they're worse in gravity. Let's be a little bit more quantitative about that. So I'd like to to do this in three steps, okay? So I'd like to consider renormalization because you know that, so we're on slide 12 right now, the one that's labeled renormalization 1. So just the fact that you have divergences in a quantum field theory doesn't necessarily mean that the quantum field theory is ridiculous nonsense. You all know that there's this procedure of renormalization that in many cases allows us to control the divergences and still get beautifully accurate experimental predictions out of that. Let's see why it is quantitatively that that goes wrong in quantum gravity. So first, let's consider not quantum mechanics at all, but just classical electrodynamics in a medium. By the way, the paradigm that I've chosen to explain how it is that renormalization works is polarization. And let's first consider just classical polarization. So we're not in vacuum. We're actually in the presence of a medium which consists of a large number of molecules, and of course those molecules consist of very concentrated positive charges and then loosely smeared out negative charges, but all pretty closely bound to one another within about, you know, a couple of Bohr radii. And then there might be a few other free charges, and what we're really interested in is how it is that those free charges move around. Okay, but we've got this infinite sea of bound charges, or not infinite, but very close to infinite, quite large Avogadro's number versus bound charges floating around. The dumb way to do that would be to say, okay, look, Gauss's law is always true, so we just take Gauss's law and we solve that for all the degrees of freedom in the bound charges. That'll work, but that's very hard and a kind of stupid way to do it. A better way to do that is to notice that the bound charges consist of things that basically cancel out, charges that basically cancel out due to the electrically neutral molecules and even atoms, and they would exactly cancel if they were right on top of each other. They aren't quite right on top of each other, so what we do is to take a series expansion in the separation. Well, usually those separations just cancel out, but if we were pumping an electric field through this, what would happen is that there'd be a systematic effect because the negative charges would move opposite to the electric field, the positive charges would move a little bit with the electric field, and then there wouldn't quite be this exact cancellation on macroscopic level. We'd wind up inducing a term which was proportional to the separation, and the separation is typically proportional to the electric field for weak fields. In other words, we'd wind up inducing a term that was proportional to the divergence of E. So these bound charges, this rho bound in that equation in Gauss's law, could actually, for all practical purposes at macroscopic distances, be written just as minus some number delta E times divergence of E. And then you notice you've got two divergence of E terms, so the smart thing to do is to put them both on the same side and wind up solving in terms of the vastly simpler number of degrees of freedom just in the handful of charges you had in row free, okay? So that's how we deal with classical polarization, and I think everybody's very, very familiar with that. Let's now see how that works in quantum electrodynamics, because actually it's exactly the same thing in quantum electrodynamics and in any quantum field theory, qualitatively speaking. So let's go now to slide number 13, the one that's labeled renormalization 2, and deals with exactly that same field equation, but in quantum electrodynamics. And remember, I told you that the field equations of quantum field theory are exactly the same as those of classical field theory, and so they are. Gauss's law is as true in quantum electrodynamics as it is in classical electrodynamics. And I'd like to break the row up into a few number of excited states where we just put in, electrons or protons or something, and then the vast, vast, vast number of charges that are all in vacuum but undergoing the unavoidable zero-point motion. And it's that zero-point motion which induces the polarization effect. And it's exactly the same thing as occurs in the classical theory. That is, you can think of the zero-point motion as causing electrons and positrons, or whatever charge field you have, to exist briefly. How long do they exist? Well, they exist as long as the phases in the mode functions would allow them to exist before they had destructive interference. So for example, if we look at a positron with energy E, script E of K is equal to H bar C squared plus M squared C to the fourth, take the square root of that, and a electron with energy E of K for P vector minus K vector, then that would live by the energy time uncertainty principle a time about equal to H bar over E plus E of K plus E of P minus K, okay? Okay, so if they're living that amount of time, how long, and by the way, that's all you need from quantum field theory in order to understand why vacuum polarization occurs. So you can actually understand almost all quantum field theoretic effects by just saying, okay, suppose that there are these virtual particles that exist for a period of time coming from the zero-point motion of the fields, and then just forget that you're dealing with quantum field theory after that. Just say, okay, what would classical physics do to that? So let's do that. Okay, so we've got these this positron and electron, which for some reason only live that amount of time. What would they do? Well, of course, the if they feel an electric field, the positron is going to move with it. The electron is going to move opposite to it, and that's going to induce a polarization. And how do we figure out what that polarization is? Well, we calculate the distance that they move in the amount of time that they exist, and then we multiply that by the charge, and that gives us the polarization, which was induced by that particular pair of particles. Then we just add up all the particles, that is, we sum over all the modes, and that should give us the net total polarization density. Okay? So this is actually slide 13, and in the English-speaking world, anyway, 13 is an unlucky number, and when I made this slide Sunday, I was pretty tired, and I made actually two mistakes in it. The first of them is visible on the equation, which is supposed to be the Lorentz force law. So that reads d by dt of, if you work out what the factors of m times gamma are in the Lorentz force law, that would be the energy over c squared, but it should be multiplied by not delta x, but delta x dot. There should be a dot over that x. And, of course, that's equal to E times the electric field. What is the electric field at? Well, it's the Fourier transform of the electric field evaluated at momentum p. Okay? In that amount of time, how long, if you just integrate that equation and don't worry too much about the change in energy, how far would the things separate? They'd separate an amount of distance delta t squared, because you're integrating away two derivatives, times c squared e times little e times capital E over two times that energy, okay? And now what you do is just sum over k in order to get the total polarization. And up to a factor of 8 thirds, which you can't get by this qualitative reasoning, that gives exactly the correct result, the real result that you get from quantum electrodynamics. So this is not just high-grade bullshit. This is really a correct way to think about it. And that result, though, for the polarization contains my second error on this slide. The electric field vector there should be evaluated not at K vector, the thing that's being summed over, but at P vector. So the idea is we have an electric field with momentum P and then a positron with momentum K and an electron with momentum P minus K is coming out of it, so it conserves momentum, three momentum, but not energy. And I apologize for that slide being a little bit wrong. Anyway, if you look at that, you can see that that integral diverges, but it doesn't diverge very badly. It only diverges logarithmically, okay, because each E at large K just goes like K, and you've got an integral d3K then over K to the third, so that diverges logarithmically. So if you imagine taking that that integral, that K integration, and expanding in powers of P, the momentum of the electric field, if I had done it right, you wouldn't have to expand very far before you would get all finite results. Actually, it would only be the zeroth order term, the term when P was equal to zero, that would diverge. All the other terms in the series expansion of that would be completely finite. So what that tells you is that the induced polarization, that is, all of the integral except for the electric field, consists of a part of it evaluated at P equals zero, which is divergent, plus everything else, which is finite. Well, let's go back to the previous slide, 12, the one that's renormalization 1. Now you see that we've got exactly the same situation, right? We've got delta epsilon has got a divergence in it, but qualitatively speaking, it's exactly the same situation. And so we add the two things together. We add epsilon naught plus delta epsilon, and we also put in the insight that we really didn't know what delta epsilon was. The only thing we knew was what the total epsilon was for zero momentum. So, in fact, if we take epsilon naught to be equal to minus the divergence plus the measured value, we'll get a finite result. So now let's go back to slide 13. We'll get a finite result. We, of course, have just forced that result to come out to be right, but the rest of the finite terms in there contain real predictions, and those predictions can be checked, and guess what? They're all right. As far as we've been able to measure, those predictions are right. So although we had to force one thing to come out to be right, we lost one prediction of the theory by that, everything else comes out to be right, and there's an infinite number of everything else's that come out to be right. So that's why particle theorists are pretty happy with renormalization. So let's move on now to slide number 14, the one that's labeled renormalization 3. And that deals with why we're not so happy about it in quantum general relativity. So the equations of quantum general relativity, if I multiply the Newton's constant back on the other side of the field equations, the way it would actually have come from the variational principle, and wrote it out, would be c squared over 8 pi g times Einstein's tensor, and I'll put in the cosmological constant term as well, is equal to the matter stress tensor, okay? And just as before, just as with the current density in quantum electrodynamics, I want to break that stress tensor up into the few number of particles that are actually real particles that are put in by hand in whatever experiment we're trying to do, plus the infinite number of quantum fields which are just undergoing zero-point motion, and I want to look at the zero-point motion of the stress tensor, okay? And let's remind ourselves of what just went on with quantum electrodynamics. When we did that with quantum electrodynamics, if we didn't write it in terms of the electric field, but rather the scalar potential and considered static sources, we would have gotten that rho zero point could be written like I've written it, like I've expressed it there, as first a Fourier transform of the potential, and then multiplying by this this thing that we recognize as the momentum-dependent polarization shift, and then a Fourier transform to put it back into space. Okay. And just as I took you through before, it would only be that the first term, or if we then imagined doing an expansion of that momentum-dependent polarization shift, we would get that only the first term depended upon the cutoff. I've just put in a momentum cutoff at little k is equal to capital K. And it would only be that first term that depended on the cutoff. Everything else would be finite, or excuse me, that first term that diverged when the cutoff went to infinity. It would only be that first term that diverged. Everything else would be finite. And, you know, I can see I've made another error in that in the slides that I prepared over the weekend. That should be del squared of phi rather than phi, okay? So it would be del squared of phi, and it would just go over with the other side. And, of course, we could just absorb that divergence into our definition of epsilon naught, okay? And that's what renormalization is. So the idea is that you've got a bunch of free parameters in the classical equations, which you don't know what they are, and you just force the effect of zero-point motion plus those free parameters to come out to agree with what you measure in real life. Okay? So let's imagine how that same thing works for the zero-point motion that affects the stress tensor. Well, the stress tensor is a much more complicated thing than energy density, so I'm not going to give you a derivation of that, but basically the result has exactly the same form as for electrodynamics with just two differences. First, of course, the dynamical variable, the analog of the potential, is the graviton field, H mu nu, And so that's why I've got H of P rather than phi of P sitting there. And secondly, because gravity couples to energy density rather than to a charge, which is independent of K, I've got four factors of the energy or of something with dimensions of energy upstairs in that numerator, whereas I only had two factors of it in electrodynamics. So I just had a P squared up there for electrodynamics, whereas I would wind up having something that involves four momenta variously distributed for gravity, okay? And it turns out that those four don't have to just be P. They could be K as well. So this integral can wind up having up to quartic divergences. So instead of just diverging logarithmically like the quantum electrodynamic case goes, it could have quartic divergences and quadratic ones and also logarithmic ones. And just as before, we wind up doing an expansion of this thing in powers of P, the momentum carried by the graviton. And after we do the final Fourier transform, the integral D3P, we're going to get all those factors of P to just become derivative operators acting on the graviton field. And the thing will take the form of a pure number times K to the fourth times H with no derivatives, plus a pure number times K squared times two derivatives of H, plus a pure number times logarithm of K squared times four derivatives of H, and then everything after that is finite, okay? And you can go through and do the calculation explicitly, but actually at the qualitative level, all we need to understand is this. So now let's go seeing what we can do in terms of absorbing these divergences in the gravitational field equation. Well, the worst divergences actually do have parameters that can absorb them. There is a term, let's take the K to the fourth term. It's characterized by not having any derivatives of the graviton field, and there is a term in Einstein's field equations which doesn't have any derivatives of the graviton field. It's the cosmological constant term. So by changing the cosmological constant term by actually taking the sum of the classical piece plus this quantum piece, quantum correction to it, we could wind up getting a finite result for that, and in agreement with about the very tiny measured value. Similarly, the term which has two derivatives of H also exists in the Einstein equation. It's the Einstein tensor term. So that term we could also deal with. That term has a free parameter that we could adjust to absorb the divergence. The problematic term is the least divergent of the term, not the worst divergence of them. It's the C times logarithm of K squared del to the fourth H. There aren't any terms in Einstein's equations involving four derivatives. So at this stage, we have to make a choice. We either add such terms into the field equations, or we have a theory which has divergences in it, okay? And obviously, it seems like it would be better to add such terms, but it turns out that there's a terrible problem associated with doing that. So let's move to slide 15. Which deals with what goes wrong if you add higher derivatives to the theory, okay? And first point I want to make is that it's not just higher spatial derivatives. In the example I previously presented, I made everything static so that I could get a simple analysis of it, but really, of course, time and space are mingled together, and if you're adding higher spatial derivatives, you have to also add higher time derivatives. So you'd be adding higher time derivatives. So what goes wrong when you do that? And that's actually a question that you could ask more generally, and that is, why is it that Newton was right when he said that F is equal to ma, right? Why is Newton's second law right? And let's review how Newton's second law works. So if you have something like m times x double dot is equal to some force written in terms of x and x dot, maybe also explicitly time, which is the paradigm for every single one of the systems that we've studied in the 350 years since Newton, then if we thought about that as being derived from a Lagrangian, it would be a Lagrangian that involved just the dynamical variable, in this case x of t and x dot of t. And let's think about what the Hamiltonian of that looks like. So since there's two pieces of initial value data, there have to be two canonical coordinates, and they're usually taken to be capital Q is equal to X and capital P is equal to dl dx dot. And if the theory is non-degenerate, that is, if you can solve that equation for P in terms of X dot, that is, find X dot of Q and P, then you can write down the Hamiltonian, and it takes the form that Hamilton wrote down so long ago. And that works great. That generates that the Hamiltonian equations of motion reproduce those canonical definitions, and they also reproduce the Euler-Lagrange equations. And every single physical system that we've seen basically adopts that or is described in that way. Well, what would happen if you had a higher derivative field equation? So suppose that instead of having second derivatives, suppose that you had fourth derivatives. Then instead of having mx double dot, you'd have something like mx to the four dots is equal to a force built out of x, x dot, x double dot, and x triple dot. And that would have come from a Lagrangian that had x, x dot, and x double dot. So you can see that from the field equations, the initial value data is going to be x0 and x0 dot, and also x0 double dot and x0 triple dot. That's four pieces of initial value data, so you're going to need four canonical coordinates. There are many, many ways to choose them, just as there are many ways to choose them in the lower derivative case. A nice choice is the one that Ostrogradsky made way back in 1850, and it is to take the two canonical coordinates to be capital Q1 is equal to X and capital Q2 is equal to X dot, and then the two canonical momenta are P2 is equal to dl dx double dot and P1 is equal to a more complicated thing. And you, just as you have to be able to invert one of the equations to solve for the velocity in terms of the momentum and coordinates, so you have to be able to invert that equation for P2, okay? So you have to be able to solve that for x double dot in terms of P2, Q1, and Q2. But nothing else. You don't need x triple dot in order to construct the Hamiltonian. And if you write down the Hamiltonian, it takes the usual form, namely pk times xk dot, which if you write it out would be p1 q1 plus p2 times that function that inverts the p2 equation, and then minus the Lagrangian written in canonical form. And if you just take the Ostrogradsky equations of motion, that is x dot is equal to dp d, or q dot is equal to dp d, or dx dp, and p dot is equal to minus dh d, dq, you wind up reproducing that whole structure of canonical definitions that I gave, and then also the Euler-Lagrange equation. So this thing generates time evolution, and also if you had a Lagrangian that was independent of time, this thing would be the nether current that would be conserved by Noether's theorem. So by anybody's definition, this is the Hamiltonian, the one and only the true Hamiltonian. It has a terrible, terrible problem, and you can see it because that first term, P1, Q2, is the only one that involves P1. There is no other dependence on P1. There could be complicated nonlinear dependence on P2, but there's only just linear dependence on P1. That could never, ever, ever be a stable theory, okay? And at this stage, I think actually this audience probably won't object to this too much, but I usually speak to particle theorists, and particle theorists just absolutely hate to be told that they can't do something. So when they see a result like this, they just go apeshit. They go crazy, and they think of all these weird, torturous ways in which they might try and evade it and get a model that had higher derivatives and was still okay. I'm not going to attempt to convince you that that would be a whole talk in itself. I'm not going to attempt to convince you that that all those ideas are wrong, but let's just use a little bit of common sense. Ever since Newton originally proposed F equals ma as the form of all dynamics, every single system in 350 monotonous years of investigation has had that form. That couldn't possibly have been an accident. There had to be some reason behind that. This is the reason, okay? So what happens if you add those fourth derivatives that we would need in order to control the divergence of quantum gravity is you get a theory actually that's perturbatively finite, so you can control all the divergences, but it's unstable, and the universe would decay instantly. The way to tell experimentally that we're, you know, remember I was talking about doing experiments on trying to compare different quantum theories. If you were in that theory, the typical experiment that you could do to immediately show if you wanted to see whether you were in that theory, an experiment that you could do that would be absolutely decisive would be to look at your watch, see it tick off 1 second, and if you were still there, you would have proven that that theory was not right. Because it predicts that the universe would decay instantly into a maelstrom of positive and negative energy pairs, and that's not happening in our universe, okay? So it's sometimes a little bit hard to do quantum gravity experiments, but that one's easy, and we can already see that the result is wrong. So let's shift to transparency 16, the one that's talking about perturbative quantum gravity. And, of course, you also can see that the other option that I gave you of just leaving the divergence in the theory is wrong, too, because one prediction of it is that when I wave my arms back and forth, we generated enough hard graviton radiation that everybody in the room and everybody, indeed, on the whole planet was fried after the appropriate light time lag, and that's not true either. So something is wrong. Why is that wrong thing happening in perturbative quantum gravity, even though it didn't happen in the other force laws? And the reason why is that the other forces, all quantum field theories tend to have divergences because they have an infinite number of modes, and in perturbation theory, the effects of those modes just add up. But the thing that couples to the other forces is charges, and those charges are constant, independent of what the mode number K is, okay? So those are the same for all modes. And that means that they don't get any worse as you get high up in mode number. Quantum gravity, unfortunately for it, couples to energy density, not to to a charge, and that gets worse as you get higher up. That's why there was that extra factor of E squared in the integrals that we had, and that's why instead of just stopping with a K squared correction, a del squared correction to the field equations, you actually need a del to the fourth correction of the field equations, and that's why this terrible unsatisfactory situation is occurring in quantum gravity. So I've now answered why it is that the divergences are worse in quantum gravity than they are in other field theories. And I'd like to move on to slide number 17, which is the divergent opinions about this. And basically, you know, again, in very, very rough schematic form, the community breaks down between two groups, relativists who love general relativity, and they would argue that perturbation theory must be wrong, and what they believe is that nonlinear quantum gravitational interactions must cancel the divergences, and roughly speaking, particle theorists, even though I'm a particle theorist and I sort of believe what the relativists believe, who love perturbation theory. To them, it's the most beautiful thing that they ever saw, and they love it because they can use it to get answers. And in their whole body of historical evolution, the people who've been right have been the people who've just taken it and ruthlessly used it to get results and then ruthlessly thrown away any sort of theory that didn't agree with the results. And that's how we got the Standard Model. That's how we got the great successes of particle theory. And so they regard as a crackpot and a fool anybody who gets too attached to one particular theory and isn't willing to throw it away on the basis of perturbative results like the ones that I've just described. So their view is that general relativity is wrong, and what they have to do is to somehow change the theory of gravity to make it not have that divergence problem, and recall that the problem is happening because gravity is coupling too strongly. The source of gravity is growing, actually, with the mode number. So what they'll do is to do two things. They'll introduce supersymmetry so that there are plus and minus energies that tend to cancel out, and then they also, in superstring theory, change the interaction so that instead of going just like plus or minus k, it actually goes like e to the minus k squared over a constant times plus or minus k, and that exponential, of course, makes things converge very, very much better. So those are the sort of two divergent groups of thought on this. Let's move on to slide number 18, And like I told you, I'm a particle theorist, but I actually have a lot of sympathy for the relativist point of view. And let me deal with a question that my particle theory colleagues often ask the relativists, the people who believe that general relativity might make sense non-perturbatively, and they usually ask it in the form of a sort of exasperated argument almost, and that is, let's look around us. It is an observational fact that classical general relativity describes everything we can see in terms of gravity. We have never seen anything that cannot be, at low energy anyway, that cannot be described by classical general relativity. So that means, that must mean that whatever is the right theory of quantum gravitational effects, at least the simple ones that we would look at, are either very, very small or else they're masquerading as something else. Well, perturbation theory is supposed to be good when you've basically got the right theory to begin with and then you make only small perturbations about it. Observationally, that has to be the correct situation because of the facts that we just discussed. How, therefore, can you guys not accept perturbation theory, which is telling you that quantum general relativity is a bad theory? And I would give two responses to that. First, although I tried to convince you that asymptotic series must be a useful way to understand quantum gravity at low energy and that the asymptotic series for quantum gravity has to be fantastically better than that for even quantum electrodynamics, for which it's already great, it isn't necessarily true that it has to wind up being the asymptotic series that we get from conventional perturbation theory. It would actually explain everything that we see in quantum general relativity if the series, instead of just being powers of Newton's constant, also involved logarithms of Newton's constant. Because then if you tried to beat it into the form of involving powers, only powers of Newton's constant, you would wind up getting uncontrollable logarithmic divergences, which is exactly what we do get. Unfortunately, we just don't have an analytic technique that's powerful enough to catch the possibility of those logarithms. So, but I think, you know, it's entirely possible that they are there, and the strategy for going after them would be not to try and get everything all at once, but to just pick one thing that everybody was pretty sure represented a physical thing, and then to try and develop an alternate series expansion for that one thing that was powerful enough to see the possibility of logarithmic correction terms like might be there. And I think that's an entirely reasonable point of view, and I'm actually working on that a little bit. The second answer that I would make is that it may be that even the zeroth order term diverges when G goes to zero. So it may be that there are quantum gravitational effects that are going around that occur in everyday life that are masquerading as something else that we just don't recognize as a quantum gravitational effect. And let's go to slide number 19, which is an example of what I think might be happening for classical general relativity. So let's consider a charged shell of radius r as r goes to zero, and let's consider it first without gravity and then with gravity. And this is repeating a calculation done by Arnowit, Deser, and Misner back in 1960. So without gravity, if we tried to calculate the mass energy of the thing, we would say that it's whatever bare mass energy we had, plus the infinite electrodynamic effect, and we would renormalize that, just the way that I did in quantum electrodynamics for the polarization, by just saying that, well, we don't know what the bare mass is. Let's just set that equal to the observed mass minus the divergence that you get from the self-energy, and that would work. But with general relativity, there's a better possibility, or at least a different possibility around, and that is if you just considered adding in the general relativistic effect. Of course, you should do this with full-blown general relativity, and ADM did, but it turns out you get exactly the right result if you just consider it at the Newtonian level the way I did and put in the Newtonian self-energy as minus gm squared over 2r. So the only concession we're making to general relativity is that that's the full mass in there rather than the bare mass. Okay? Well, that's a question. quadratic equation for M, and even though many of my co-national American high school students can't solve that anymore, I went to high school a long time ago, and I can still solve that, and I've given you the result there. And we actually even can take the limit when R goes to zero, and the result is finite when R goes to zero. Why did that finiteness happen? Well, it happened because gravity has a negative interaction energy and electrodynamics has a positive interaction energy. And even though electrodynamics doesn't like charges to be squished together, gravity loves stress energy to be squished together. So when you squish it and squish it together, gravity wants more and more of it and rewards you with a bigger and bigger negative energy. And in the limit, when you do the explicit calculation, they wind up canceling. Let's also notice that that's in total disagreement with the perturbative result. So the perturbative result is you identify coupling constants, in this case Q, the charge, and G, and you expand the result. We have now the exact result. You expand it in powers of those coupling constants. Well, if we did that, we would not get the result on the right. We couldn't, because the result on the right diverges when G goes to zero. What we would get is a series of oscillating, ever higher and higher divergences. And guess what? That's exactly what we do get in quantum gravity. So that's no guarantee that quantum gravity divergences will make sense. But if we had a technique, if we had the analytical power to do what I can do in this simple classical result, it might be that they resolve themselves into harmless results, and it might be that that the series that we're getting in quantum general relativity just isn't right, that it isn't even analytic in the Newton's constant. Okay? So I'd like to move now to slide number 20. And that is that if you've noticed it, actually all of the proposed fixes involve negative energy. The relativist dream that I just sort of discussed, of course, involves negative energy. The particle theorist does too, because in super anything, the energy of the vacuum energy of fermions, even though they have positive energy, when you create a fermion, their zero-point energy is negative, and it's those cancellations that are responsible for a good bit of the finiteness that's going on in string theory and for all of the finiteness that might be happening in N equals 8 supergravity. And even if you take perturbative gravity's wish, which is just to include the higher derivatives, that would wind up also, as I showed you, giving negative energy. So maybe the universe is trying to tell us something, that all the fixes seem to point towards negative energy in some form or another. Okay, the other big problem, of course, is experiments. As I told you when I was discussing the asymptotic series, suppose we got a theory of quantum gravity that was perturbatively finite, and it had something like that form that I was dealing with. Even if there were logarithms in the series, it wouldn't make any difference, because that constant, or those numbers for G E squared over H bar C to the fifth, are just so small for any energy that we could reach, that even if you wound up having 10 to the minus 32 times logarithm of 10 to the minus 32, that would be a factor of 100 or so enhancement over the naive result, so vastly bigger than otherwise, but still way, 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 way unobservable. So we need to have some way of, if we had two theories of quantum gravity, telling the difference between them and understanding them quantitatively. Okay, and that's actually not an unknown problem in quantum field theory, because we're used to dealing with weak interactions. The way you study a weak interaction is to try and identify its unique features. For example, in the weak interaction, we didn't see it by looking in the background of quantum electrodynamics. We saw it because it mediates decays that don't even occur in quantum electrodynamics. So it pays to sort of identify unique features of gravity, and I'd like to present two for your consideration. The first I already discussed, negative interaction energy. So it could be that every time we measure a particle mass, we're, unbeknownst to us, doing an experiment in quantum gravity. Another feature that interests me a lot is that, and this has to do with the dynamical gravitons that haven't played too much of a role in my talk, and that is that dynamical gravitons do a funny thing. They're massless without having classical conformal invariance. Conformal invariance means, as you know probably, or Weyl invariance, as it's sometimes called, is when you take the metric and multiply it by omega squared, where omega squared could be an arbitrary function of space and time. And all other theories or all other common fields that become massless have the property that they're invariant classically under that symmetry. Gravity is the unique one that isn't. And that's really important because doing that is just exactly what cosmology achieves. That is, if you take the FRW metric that I've written down on the penultimate line and go to what's called conformal coordinates, then the expansion of the universe can be regarded as doing exactly that kind of a transformation. And that's sort of a bummer for somebody looking for long-range quantum effects, because all the long-range effects would have to come from massless particles, and most of the massless particles can't tell the difference between being in an expanding universe and not, so they're not going to be very sensitive to that. Gravity is the unique one, which has the property that it's long-range and it knows about the expansion of space-time. So that suggests that that would also be a natural venue to look for quantum effects. Well, I'm over time, and that's good because I'm also done. So let me just review the seven questions that I posed in the beginning and answer them. So the first question was, how can quantum general relativity, that is, be so bad when classical general relativity works so well? And the answer is that classical general relativity only works really well when you turn off all the degrees of freedom, or almost all the degrees of freedom. You can do that classically, and it's totally okay. You can't do that quantum mechanically. And if you allow them to have even just their zero-point motion, that's already enough to screw quantum gravity up. Okay, and we saw that semi-quantitatively. The second question is, why do you even have to quantize gravity? And as far as gravitons go, you don't have to. That is, there's no evidence, there's no... We haven't seen gravitational radiation yet, although we have indirect evidence from the spin of the binary pulsar that gravitational radiation exists. There's no evidence at all that it's quantized. But part of the metric comes from quantum matter. That's actually the part that's responsible for the lowest order divergences. And there's no question that that is quantum mechanical just because the matter is quantum mechanical. And like I say, that's already responsible for the lowest order divergences in quantum gravity, and it's been seen experimentally. The first quantum gravitational effect has actually been seen in the inflationary theory of density perturbations. It's what's responsible for the CMB anisotropies and for the initial distribution of delta rho over rho, and so you have to quantize it. Third question was, where do the divergences come from? Well, they come from the fact that there are an infinite number of modes. The continuum field theories have an infinite number of modes. The reason that the divergences in quantum gravity are worse than those of other theories is that in the other theories, the force couples to charge, and that's a constant that doesn't grow with the mode number, whereas in gravity it couples to energy, and that does grow with the mode number, and that's responsible for pushing it over the threshold of numbers of derivatives that you can allow in counter terms. Let's move to the last slide, which is slide number 23, and deals with the fifth question, which is, how bad is the effect? And or how bad is the divergence? And it turns out that pure gravity is actually okay at one loop. It would diverge at two loops, so that's the effect of gravitons that I told you was bad, but not the first thing that happens. The first thing that happens is that gravity plus almost any kind of matter diverges at one loop order. The exception would be gravity plus supersymmetric matter. That's okay at one loop order. And the sixth question was, what are the schools of thought about this, and why do they disagree? And the schools of thought could be, in my own notation, broken up into relativists who think that general relativity must be right and that perturbation theory is the suspect thing, or particle theorists who think that perturbation theory is right and general relativity is the suspect thing. And the fifth thing is, what would we do with a theory of quantum general relativity if we had it? And my answer would be that we ought to look for that the effects are going to be small at ordinary energies, but we ought to look for unique properties of gravity and try and see quantum gravitational effects from them, because then no matter how small it is, if you see anything, then you've seen it. Okay, and two of those things that I submit for your consideration are that the interaction energy of gravity is negative and that gravitons have zero mass without conformal invariance. Okay, I'm sorry for going a little bit over, but I'm done now.
Thank you. Two questions?
Hi, Richard.
Hey, John.
Former collaborator.
Oh, yes.
It seems to me that the villain got gravity is the 0-point-back community.
Yes.
The source of the villain. As far as particle physics is concerned.
It's so, responsible for almost all quantum field theoretic effects.
Yes. So, this issue of negative energy, is it somehow possible to... I've been working on this fringe idea. Somehow possible to have negative energy particles somehow involved in quantum field theory and gravity, and not have the universe disappear instantly.
Well, you'd probably know more about that than I would if you've been working on it. I've never found a way to do that. The typical thing in an interacting field theory is that if you have interactions, then the degrees of freedom allow things to go into everything else. And, of course, you know the big reason why having negative energy particles is bad is because the universe would then get driven by entropy, basically, to being very, very, very highly excited. So ordinarily we could ignore, except in vacuum fluctuations, we could ignore the effects of very, very high energy particles, because everything is positive energy, and to excite one of those degrees of freedom, we have to take the energy out of somewhere else, and there's only a finite amount of energy available within our local environment to do that. That would be exactly wrong if you wound up having negative energy degrees of freedom, because then you not only could excite them, but you'd actually free up energy that you could use to excite positive energy degrees of freedom. And that's why with something like the kinetic Ostrogradsky instability, the universe would just immediately evaporate into a maelstrom of positive and negative energy pairs, that there would not even be any barrier to decay. It would go so quick that you couldn't even say properly that it had ever existed. You have to then, if you want to have negative energy degrees of freedom, you have to come up with some way of preventing that sort of decay from coupling, from occurring. And I don't see any way of doing that, but maybe that's just because I've not been clever enough to see it.
I just want to pursue this a bit further. The issue of negative energy has always been a problem since Dirac. As you know, in the history
yeah, sure.
of the Dirac equation, the 3 years went by more before people began to realize that Dirac was right. He had his whole theory. They had an infinite sea of negative energy particles.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as he got the 2 for G, I think most people thought there had to be. He couldn't have been totally wrong, but you're right. It took a long time before they found a way of resolving the negative energy effect.
So it seems to me that the turning point there was that people eventually gave up the Dirac Hall theory. They went into quantum field theory and positive and negative energy fields.
Right, and so instead of regarding the Dirac field as the wave function of a first quantized theory, they regarded it as the field of a second quantized theory.
Exactly. But the price paid was to bring in this nasty zero-point vacuum energy, which we've been living with ever since.
Yeah.
The cosmological constant problem is the most serious problem in modern physics.
You're right.
No one seems to be able to solve it. So maybe the clue is that we never really understood how to deal with negative energy particles in the vacuum.
Well, I'd say it's certainly true that we don't know how to deal with We don't know how to get any. We don't know how to have a theory which has them, and get anything like the universe that we know out of anyway. So one possibility, that the possibility that most people believe, is that it could be that that you just shouldn't do it. Another possibility is that there's some way of doing it that we just haven't hit upon, and I gather that's what you're working on.
That's right. So in the case of supersymmetry, it's very interesting that the zero-point vacuum energy cancels because of the positive and negative differences in the energies. Exactly what happens. So the question is, you know, the price there is that you have to double the number of particles.
Right.
Get involved with particles we've never seen. And we have 121 free parameters in the minimal supersymmetric model.
Right, and even then it doesn't really work, right?
No.
Because n equals 8 supergravity might be finite, but n equals 8 can't describe our universe. It's a universe that's completely massless, that's got hideous infrared divergences, that doesn't have anything like the chiral fermion structure that we see in our physical universe. So it's... And any theory that would wind up having masses, as soon as you're going to have to break supersymmetry, and as soon as you do that, then you're getting back divergences that that could give unacceptably large values to things like the cosmological constant.
So the question is, why is it that supersymmetry, zero-point vacuum energy cancels, and we get away with it?
You mean in unbroken supersymmetry or in the real life?
Yeah,
I'm not sure that that is what's happening in real life. I wish I knew what was happening in real life.
More questions?
Yeah, so this is Abhay, and I have a comment and then some questions. First of all, thanks very much for this beautiful talk, and for people who are in the more quantum gravity or relativity audience, I just want to say that Richard has written a detailed review paper, which would be also very illuminating for students and postdocs to read.
Thank you very much for the advertisement, Abhay, and I should say that Abhay was a great help to me in writing the paper, too, so thank you very much.
Okay. So my comment really is it's a slight difference from the way that you put it. I mean, you sort of emphasize that classical general relativity works when almost all degrees of freedom are off. And it's certainly true in the sense that, you know, if you look at the cosmological scenario where to begin with, at least, for the Friedman background, this is correct. And also for the solar system test, it is correct. But if I were to really ask the question kind of in terms of mathematical physics, then we do have this really interesting global theorems which say that so long as, you know, the initial data is weak, then even with nonlinear effects of full general relativity, the classical S matrix is perfectly well defined, and this is the work of, you know, Christodoulou, Kleinemann, and several other people since then. So I think it is, to me that is, it is important that we have...
Oh, I'm sorry, Abhay. I didn't mean to contradict that work at all. When I said classical general relativity works with all the degrees of freedom off, what I meant was experimental tests of
it. Right.
I absolutely did not mean to contradict the beautiful and wonderful and fundamental theoretical work that's been done on understanding the initial value formalism of general relativity and talking about that. I please forgive me if
no,
I gave
no,
that
no,
impression.
I
didn't mean to imply that at all. I meant I was talking about agreement with experiment and the classic experiments of general relativity are all, or not all of them, but most of them are solar system experiments based on Schwarzschild or tiny perturbations of Schwarzschild, and those are the reason why that works so well. Well, I already said that, so.
Right. Okay, so my questions are the following. This is on this transparency, which you called repart free with relativists. So there are 2 points there. One is about... the second point, let me begin with, which is the zeroth order terms themselves may diverge as g goes to zero. And This also seems to me conceptually similar to the general idea that was first proposed by Steven Weinberg and then has been pursued with great detail by Reuter and so on. That perhaps
really, I thought that they were trying to have it be an analytic series expansion in G.
Well, but the idea was that you don't want the fixed point should not be Minkowski space, should not be Gaussian fixed point. It will not look like a perturbation, you know, it should be a non-trivial fixed point.
Right, it should be non-trivial, but for the rest of the audience, let me say what we're talking about. We're talking about the idea that, as Abai said, was first proposed by Weinberg and has been worked on extensively recently by Reuter, Bonanno, Lauscher, some other names that I'm forgetting right off the spur of the moment, and I'm sorry. And it's called asymptotic safety, and the idea is that you just go ahead and let there be counterterms there, but you don't treat them non-perturbatively the way that that would cause the theory to be to become renormalizable, but also give it extra degrees of freedom. You only treat the higher derivative counterterms perturbatively, so they don't acquire any new degrees of freedom. That can't serve as a fundamental definition of the theory because perturbation theory can't define the theory. It would miss things, and it can't be summed up in any case. But I was arguing to you, you know, that just by getting the asymptotic series expansion, we ought to, for all experimental purposes, be able to be in pretty good shape with quantum gravity. And it could well do that, provided that that the other problem that would occur in that case, and that is that you would need more and more and more counterterms, and remember, with each counterterm, you lose a prediction, provided that that problem could be controlled. That is, provided you'd wind up having a reasonably predictive theory, one wouldn't have to just force an infinite number of things to come out to be right in order to fix all those constants. And the idea of asymptotic safety is normalization group idea, and that is that they would theory, and even if you wanted to be really niggling, you could say, well, suppose I'm not at that fixed point or near that fixed point. For all practical purposes, it would probably be a pretty good approximation and the arbitrary high energy regime to just set constants to their values at the fixed point, or if even all but a finite number of them would approach a fixed point and you had to use up predictions to set some finite number of them, then I would think we'd be in pretty good shape, at least as far as comparing with experiments. I'm sorry for the interjection. Please go ahead with your question.
So I just wanted to say that, so that is another possibility right here, which is perfectly fine with the general philosophy.
I agree.
Okay. And second quick question was about, or maybe it's not so quick, is about the first point that you made, which is correct series, which is non-analytic in G. So what you said that you have been thinking about this, and are there any insights that you care to share with us about such an expansion, availability or non-availability or problems? Or?
Well, I think I've got an asymptotic. So I think trying to get a non, or trying to do the, so. If I had infinite calculational ability, what would I do? Like calculating a particle mass, like what ADM did, and I would do the calculation exactly. That's hopeless. So I think what you need to do is to try and develop an alternate series expansion, so still be doing perturbation theory, but basically resumming an infinite subclass of diagrams in such a way that you give gravity an opportunity to react at each order in perturbation theory to the thing which is causing the problem. I'm working on developing such a series expansion. I haven't got any results that I'd care to announce right yet, but I think I will later on in the fall have some, and I think there may well be a way to do it. Let me waffle at that stage.
Okay. Thank you.
More questions?
I have a question. Hi, sir. This is Niyesh.
Hey, Niyesh. You're at Perimeter now?
Yes, I am. I've been for the past 2 years, but... Yeah, so I have a question now. So when you claim that CMBN isotropy is an evidence for quantized gravity... So
I think I phrased it in a more conservative fashion. I said that under the simplest interpretation of the CMB anisotropies, they're evidence for quantum gravity, yeah.
And I assume you're referring to the inflationary paradigm.
That's right.
So in inflationary paradigm, the thing that does give, lead to anisotropy is the scalar field perturbation, the quantization of the scalar field perturbation.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, an alternative interpretation could be that if there is some sort of a measurement of the coherence process that happens for the scalar field, where quantum fluctuations of a scalar field become classical, then it's just what you're just saying is the gravitational effect of classical perturbation of the scalar field rather than quantum gravity.
Well, so what distinction? See, one of my big points is that there's a part of the metric field which is just controlled by the matter stress tensor. So you give me the matter fields, what they're doing, I can tell you part of what the metric is doing, again, if I had infinite calculational ability. And you're absolutely right. It's fluctuations in that dynamical scalar inflaton, which we think is giving rise to those perturbations. But the thing that's actually being observed is fluctuations in the metric. That is, that generates then fluctuations in the metric, and it's those perturbations that are being observed. So I would say that that is a quantum gravitational effect, and in fact, exactly the quantum gravitational effect that causes the lowest order divergence in quantum gravity. So if you, there's a lot of dispute about this in the community for reasons that I don't really understand. So people want to see the graviton effect, and I'd like to too, of tensor perturbations. But actually, if I was given a choice, if I was told I could only see one of them, not the other, which would I rather see? I'd actually rather see the effect on gravity of quantum matter fields than I would see the effect on gravity of quantum graviton fields, because it's that one which is causing the lowest order problems. Gravity itself is finite at one loop order. It's only at two loop order that it screws up. So I agree with you. It's quantum matter that's generating the perturbations that we've seen so far. But those, I think it's completely fair to call those quantum gravitational effects.
But my point is that, well, you can say it has quantum origin, but then the thing is that from the time that it has quantum origin to the time that you see its gravitational effect, one may argue that there's a wave function collapse happening, that quantum mechanical fluctuations of the scalar field become classical.
And so what? Then, oh, okay, so what? Yes, you're right. So what?
So then what they said that the gravity is still classical, but it's just seeing the classical field fluctuations rather than the quantum field fluctuations.
Well, so you know what a photomultiplier tube is, right?
Sure.
So suppose I hook up a photomultiplier tube to a piece of doped polyethylene and I notice an atomic decay going off. The thing that I actually measure is not the atomic decay going off. The thing that I actually measure is a pulse of current. Would you say that I didn't see a quantum effect?
But you did see a quantum effect.
The pulse of current is classical by the time it's percolated, by the time the photon has hit the photomultiplier, the photocathodes, and there's been an amplification of the individual quantum effect by, what is it, this billions and billions of amplifications. The thing I detect is a pulse of current. That's certainly classical, right? But it was triggered by a quantum effect. I would say, I think most people would count that as a quantum effect.
Sure. I mean, I agree with you, it's a quantum effect, but you can use semi-classical gravity to account for it.
Sure. And indeed, in the calculation that I did of vacuum polarization, I also did the same thing. I said, look, just put in positrons, virtual positrons and electrons that you allow to exist for a period of time, given by the uncertainty principle. That's all you need out of quantum field theory. After that, the rest of the calculation is completely classical, and you get the result that's completely correct within a factor of 8/3. So that's quite true, but it's true of all quantum field theoretic effects, not just this one, all of them. And so I again don't see the big distinction that you're making. It seems to me that it's totally fair to call this a quantum gravitational effect, and also it tells us something. So this is something really important too, because when I was a young man, It used to be argued that we could just take gravity to be sourced by the expectation value of the stress tensor. If we make that interpretation that I think you accept, that that this is coming from quantum fluctuations of the matter field, we can't do that anymore, because the expectation value of the stress tensor would average over those things and not see the fluctuation, whereas we're actually measuring the fluctuation. So I would argue that this is the first quantum gravitational data we've ever seen, and it told us something that was non-trivial, and I think it's quite likely to tell us more non-trivial things in the future. It's too bad that we don't have the parent theory that it came from, so it would be really powerful if we knew exactly that it was this scalar field with that potential that it came from, and then we could get into seeing whether the theory was working more quantitatively. But I think it's already non-trivial, and I frankly am blown away by the fact that it even exists. I never thought I would live to see quantum gravitational data.